Hey, sweetie, your mother showed me this Carvana thing for selling the car. I'm going to give it a try. Wish me luck. Me again. I put in the license plate. It gave me an offer. Unbelievable. Okay, I accepted the offer. They're picking it up Tuesday from the driveway. I haven't even left my chair. It's done. The car is gone. I'm holding a check. Anyway, Carvana, give it a whirl. Love ya.
So good, you'll want to leave a voicemail about it. Sell your car today on Carvana. Pickup fees may apply.
Join over 1 million listeners around the world tuning into Shadow Kingdom, God's Banker, Crooked's newest true crime podcast. Now, all episodes are out now, that you can binge the full story from start to finish. As our host Niccolo investigates the mysterious death of the Vatican banker, uncovering a web of mafia ties, a fascist secret society, covert Vatican ops, and a missing $1.2 billion. He interviews spies, prosecutors, and the last person to see Roberto Calvi, the banker, alive, all to answer one question: who killed God's banker? Now, it is timely because trying to figure out who the new pope's going to be, but there's much more going on in the Vatican than I had ever known about. And this whole issue of the Vatican banker, I didn't even know there was a Vatican banker in the first place, but I learned so much listening to Shadow Kingdom. You can binge all episodes of Shadow Kingdom wherever you get your podcasts or on Apple Podcasts. Hey, this is Duray, and welcome to Posse of the People. In this episode, it's me, Miles, and Sharonda talking about the news with regard to race, justice, and equity that you might not have heard last week, or news that you did hear but didn't hear from this perspective. Make sure you join our community on Instagram at PodSaveThePeople, and here we go. We are approaching the first Monday in May, which is the Met Gala Monday, and we are excited to be back. This is Duray at D-R-A-Y on Twitter.
This is Miles E. Johnson at Miles_E_Johnson on Instagram. Shit, that is long.
And I'm Sharonda Bossier, Bossier S on Still.
Well, we talk about the Met Gala a little later, but let's talk. Start with the wild American presidency, because it just, you know, I'm a broken record, but I wake up and I'm like, oh, it'll end. And then it doesn't. So I don't know if you saw the interview that he did on network television where he was asked about, do you think that citizens and non-citizens deserve due process? And he said, I don't know.
I'm not a lawyer.
And you're like, bro, you're the president of the United States. Due process is in the Constitution. What do you mean, I don't know?
Your Secretary of State says everyone who's here, citizens and non-citizens, deserve due process. Do you agree, Mr. President?
I don't know. I'm not a lawyer. I don't know.
Well, the Fifth Amendment says,
I don't know. It might say that, but if you're talking about that, then we'd have to have 1 million or 2 million or 3 million trials. We have thousands of people that are some murderers and some drug dealers and some of the worst people on earth, some of the worst, most dangerous people on earth. And I was elected to get them the hell out of here, and the courts are holding me from doing it.
But even given those numbers that you're talking about, don't you need to uphold the Constitution of the United States as president?
I don't know. I have to respond by saying again, I have brilliant lawyers that work for me, and they are going to obviously follow what the Supreme Court said. What you said is not what I heard the Supreme Court said. They have a different interpretation.
I think you're right. I feel like we've talked about this ad nauseum, and every week it just gets wilder and wilder and wilder. And it's like, it's both that he positions himself as the ultimate decider and interpreter of the law while also pretending to be ignorant of it. And it's just so fascinating to me to watch him be able to do both things and have people be like, now, hold on, bruh. At the very least, you're going to have to pick one, you know? So, yeah.
He gets on my nerves so bad. Oh, my gosh. I cannot stand Trump. I think, again, the thing that always goes into my head during these conversations is the thirst for it, is the appetite for what he's seeing. That even when I'll see something that really feels horrific or really feels unsettling happen, or he says something especially stupid, that I also see people cheering about it and saying that they like that going on. I remember, I don't know if we're going to end up talking about PBS. I don't know everything that's on the docket. There's so much mess, but you know, I love me some PBS. But then you look into PBS's own commentary and you have people saying, you know, I love Antiques Roadshow, but girl, get out my pocket. Like, yeah. You know, there's a thirst and appetite for what we're seeing, and there's a thirst and appetite for a president who doesn't know due process, who is not an institutionalist, even though through the architecture of fascism, they're being the biggest institutionalists we probably have ever seen. But, you know.
I'm interested in this, Miles. Do you think there's an appetite for it? I think about this because I'm struck at how well Trump gets us all distracted by ridiculous things, but you can't tell if it's actually ridiculous or if he's going to do it, which is part of the strategy, because they'll say something wild and then you're like, oh, well, that sounded crazy, but then he did it. And you're like, okay, this is interesting. But I asked Miles if you think there's an appetite for it, or do people just misunderstand it? Because a part of me feels like if I said to you, like, do you think that anybody should be able to just like say somebody's a criminal and send them to another country? I would win on that. If I phrase a question like that, people would be like, okay, yeah, that's crazy. But when he says, like, when it's called due process or it sounds like some complicated government legal mechanism, then that feeds on this idea that everything's too complicated. And so part of me is like, I don't know if people actually sort of like the underlying big idea, but they don't understand it or aren't like, I don't know, or the storytelling got warped. That's what I believe in my heart. And I've been waiting to say that because I've been waiting to talk to y'all. But I'm not convinced that the appetite is like fully there for the big idea.
I disagree. But I do want to honor that reveals something really beautiful and layered about your heart, because I think that the perspectives that we see on government usually is what we're reflecting back. But no, I do think that we're in a meaner America than that question positions us. I think that if it was just about misunderstanding, if it was just about confusion and lack of clarity, then we would be talking about and critiquing Vice President Madam Harris. It's also, there is a meanness and an evil and a darkness to what we're talking about. And there is this kind of structure that the right has made for off-ramps into their fascism. So sometimes the overcomplicatedness or the vagueness is the off-ramp to be that kind of that right wing evil, but the people who participated in it, they knew what they were getting, you know, and you kind of still see that, because some of the things that we also are outraged around when you think about the immigrants and how we're seeing folks getting treated, that is a very celebrated thing too. That is not a thing that's not being celebrated. So I'm a little bit more cynical about the temperature and era we're in when it comes to American culture and us as collective citizens. I don't think it's just about misunderstanding.
Or at the very least, it's not a deal breaker, right? And so, like, I think best case scenario, people are at least willing to swallow it if they feel like they get something else they want, you know? I think it is interesting, you know, that we're also seeing him push in so many other directions and start to lose ground with some groups, right? Like we talked about a dip in support among Latino voters, et cetera. But then to DeRay's point about him saying just like wild stuff all the time, he's like, we're going to build a bigger and meaner Alcatraz. And you're like, hold on a second. Where did that come from? That's a tourist destination now, you know? And I'm just really fascinated by that too, you know? And by, are people who are so obsessed with efficiency and cutting costs, et cetera, are y'all not thinking about how expensive it's going to be to rehabilitate freaking Alcatraz so that it's habitable? What is wrong with y'all?
It is sort of nuts. And the two things that what you said made me think of. One is, Miles, I don't know if you saw, but Trump did another interview. He did it with Morin, I think is how you say his name. And Terry Morin on ABC News, and Morin said, you know, people didn't sign up for this. Like, you know, everything that's going on, people didn't sign up for a trade war is specifically what he said, but it sounded like a general comment.
It's one of the main reasons that you're back in this office. And now we have this trade war with China that Moody's and other analysts say is going to cost American families thousands of more dollars per year. And there is a lot of concern out there. People are worried. Even some people who voted for you saying, I didn't sign up for this. So how do you answer those concerns?
Well, they did sign up for it, actually, and this is what I campaigned on.
And Trump replied, well, they did sign up for it. This is what I campaigned on. And I was struck by that exchange because, you know, people joked Kamala when she talked about the tariffs, and people were like, she's being like, what are the tariffs? Ha ha ha. This is silly. Da da da. And he's like, no, I said I was going to do the tariffs. And that is true. That was not a surprise. And what you said about Alcatraz, Sharonda, is so interesting because, you know, we decommissioned it as a prison, I don't know, like more than 50 years ago. It is now run by the National Park Service. Right. It is inhospitable. You know, it is the lift. It already is losing money as a tourist destination.
Yeah,
it will certainly lose money as a prison. So you're like, is he actually wanting to open Alcatraz? Is this just a thing that he knows will take the news cycle for the next 5 days and then he moves on? Like,
or is it a undoable in the next 3 years task that somebody else can ride on? So now we are setting it up so somebody else like Mike Johnson, like somebody else who's conservative, can ride on Trumpism. So that has been kind of my reoccurring fear or reoccurring statement throughout these conversations since Trump got elected, is that because he most likely won't get a third term, I have to say that now, but because he most likely won't get a third term, I see these bigger projects and these bigger ideas being presented, so somebody else will have to see them through and finish them. And that's sometimes what I see as a pathway for Trumpism to exist without Trump, which to me is more scarier than just one icon of Trump, because, you know, that means we're a heartbeat away from exiting this neo-fascist era. But if Trumpism exists without Trump, that means that this is a generational thing we're dealing with.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Now, I remember growing up, there was a big taboo around therapy. People were like, I'm just going to go to church, or I don't need that kind of help, or that's not for me. Other people can do it. And I'm happy that I got away from those attitudes. Therapy was a huge game changer for me. I'm sad that I didn't think about therapy until it felt like the world was falling apart for me a couple years ago. And then I was in therapy twice a week, and now it's a different pace, but it was and continues to be so important to me just to have somewhere to go to process the world around me and not necessarily process it with the people that I'm living the world with every single day, my closest friends, family, loved ones. Mental health awareness is a big deal, and I'm happy that the public conversation about it is much healthier than it used to be. 26% of Americans who participated in a recent survey say they've avoided seeking mental health support due to fear of judgment. So it's gotten better, y'all, but it's still, that's a lot of people. And when people don't get the help they need, it doesn't just affect them. It affects their families, workplaces, their entire communities. This Mental Health Awareness Month, I want you to join me in encouraging everybody to take care of their well-being and to break the stigma around therapy. The world is better when people are healthy and happy. I really can't recommend therapy enough, and it's so hard to find a good therapist. That's the good thing about BetterHelp. The way to find a therapist is easy. If you want to switch therapists, it's easy. There are a ton of therapists all across the country. Like, you can do it virtually. Like, it wasn't this easy a decade ago to find a therapist. It was a really complicated, even when I found a therapist just 5 years ago, it was really complicated. And BetterHelp has over 10 years of experience matching people with the right therapist from their diverse network of more than 30,000 licensed therapists with a wide range of specialties. And it's fully online, making it affordable and convenient, and serving over 5 million people worldwide. And like I said, you can switch therapists anytime at no extra cost. We're all better with help. Visit BetterHelp.com/people to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/people.
Hey, sweetie, your mother showed me this Carvana thing for selling the car. I'm going to give it a try. Wish me luck. Me again. I put in the license plate. It gave me an offer. Unbelievable. Okay, I accepted the offer. They're picking it up Tuesday from the driveway. I haven't even left my chair. It's done. The car is gone. I'm holding a check. Anyway, Carvana, give it a whirl. Love ya.
So good, you'll want to leave a voicemail about it. Sell your car today on
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
You know who didn't benefit from this Trump era? One, Sean Diddy Combs. Yeah, for all of the connections that he has and the U.S. attorneys all over the country are dropping cases left and right. The federal government's not prosecuting people. You know, there's a famous case in L.A., Sean, I don't know if you heard, where a jury convicted police officers. The L.A. attorney undid that. You know, like, so much is happening. And, you know, Diddy was as connected as a celebrity could be connected. And, you know, it is not helping. But I bring that up because the Diddy trial is starting, and Diddy, famously in Diddy world, refused every single plea offer thrown his way. And I am, you know, I don't think there's a way for Diddy's career to recover from this. So I guess all he's trying to do is stay out of prison. Like, I feel like that must be the play, or that he feels like he can get a better deal with the jury than he can get with the plea, you know, because you don't need the whole jury to be on your side. You just need one person to. And, you know, I think he's probably banking on just getting one holdout who refuses. But I don't know, because if there's more evidence like that Cassie video, it's going to be. And the Cassie video is, frankly, enough for a lot of people to believe that more things happen, even if there's not footage. But I completely forgot that the trial starts this week.
I feel like the culture kind of moved on from Diddy really quickly. I feel like it was like, this happened, Diddy got arrested, he's in prison. And like, I don't hear about it as much anymore. Not in the same way that I think there was lots of public conversation and lots of like litigating and relitigating of other celebrities who were going on trial, right? I'm thinking about like R. Kelly as an example. I think people were like, yep, Diddy did it, and like just sort of moved on. I do, you know, as we're thinking about the trial beginning, I wonder what his lawyers are advising him versus what he's deciding, right? Like, are his lawyers also thinking that he will be able to benefit from his celebrity and like there being one holdout? I do think the cultural tide is also shifting against anything that feels like Me Too. So they might be also trying to like ride that wave a little bit. I think it'll be interesting to see what else we learn. But yeah, I think for the most part, Black people were like, nah, y'all, he did it. And we just, I that's my experience from my vantage point.
And I think I agree with everything that you said, Sharonda. And I think that this is a unique case that isolated Diddy strictly into spectacle and not into martyr, you know? And usually there's some type of gateway, but the queer stuff kind of blocked him with the straight men. The videotaping of him being a woman blocked him out with Black women's help. So he kind of isolated himself in this really unique position that makes me believe in God. I'm like, goodness. I'm like, well, that ain't hell. I don't know. Like, you know, just being that public and that crucified and having no, like, you know, even Tory Lanez to this day, R. Kelly to this day has writers and people who are saying, no, that is, you know, Roc Nation will fall, and Diddy, because of all of his transgressions in the color and dimensions of these transgressions, created this like real solitary consignment socially. Like he did that socially. So I think that's gonna be interesting. But I do disagree. I think once this case is back on and popping, like the kids say, the nachos will be reheated. And I think that if there's any hint of more celebrity interaction, if they've been holding on to something until it's needed, I mean, yeah. And last thing too, the reason why I think Trump will not touch this in any type of way, because Diddy, to a lot of conservative people, you have to remember vote or die. You have to remember a lot of Diddy's posturing was about that kind of Black neoliberal social class posturing. If we drink enough champagne and pass enough Cavassier, we can be free. And I think a part of him going down, that is like a Black Negro Epstein moment for people. So I think that him being kind of publicly crucified, whether he wants it or whether he deserves it or not, is also fodder for Trump's base. So that's why Trump, I could not see Trump saving Diddy for any reason.
I don't know if you remember, but you definitely remember this part. Eric Adams was charged with corruption by the federal prosecutors. They rolled up on him on the street, took his phones, crazy. They got the police commissioner, all this other stuff. Then Trump wins and they tell Eric Adams, like, hey, we're going to put the trial on hold. We're going to like drop it for now, but we have the right to bring it back whenever we want. A judge who actually was a civil rights lawyer before he became the judge, this judge is like, okay, you can't do that. That's like holding it over his head. That is not cool. So he dismisses the charges fully. But what a lot of people missed is that a condition of the dismissals is that all the evidence will be made public. And that is happening in the next week or so. So it will be interesting to see what happens when all the government's evidence is made public. I think Eric Adams' team or somebody's been able to delay it up until now, but it is coming. It was a part of the order. So I'm fascinated to see what that looks like.
I need to stock up on my red wine before that happens. Cause it's
I want like Great Oracle.
Yes.
Shonda Rhimes to stop writing. I want her to close out this series and stop it, because this might just be like a little bit of an opening. Now that you positioned all the things happening this week prior, what we're looking towards between the Met Gala and Diddy and Eric Adams, we might be looking, I mean, this might be a couple of moments before a whole new rupture in 2025 happens, because that's a lot of things going on. And all Black men focus. That's interesting, right?
I was just getting ready to say, is this the second Cat Williams portal opening?
Cat really didn't meet, and Cat doesn't know that Cat set up Shannon too. Listen. Like it was a long setup. You have what was that line? You have an unintelligible fascination with losers or whatever that line was.
Yes.
Oh yes. 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 Yes.
He was actually talking about you, Shannon. Like exactly. You are the loser too.
Yes.
You have a fascination with.
And baby. Did y'all see that interview?
The Cat Williams interview.
No, the interview with one of Shannon Sharpe's accusers. She's a redheaded woman.
Yes.
Oh, the other woman, not even the one from the recent.
Whew, yeah.
That one was so, I'm sorry just to like, to make a hard left, but you said Shannon Sharpe and I had just saw it and I was like, whoa, this is wild. I thought, I don't know, that interview felt more damning than anything, maybe because it was an interview and not just on paper or on form, but it felt so damning. And there is, speaking of, I think even with the success of Sinners, like, I think that even with the success of Ryan Coogler and Michael B. Jordan, I think there's just something shifting in, like, the platonic, like, structure of public Black manhood in front of our eyes.
What was the interview like? Can you explain the interview to us?
So the interview was of her recalling her relationship with Shannon Sharpe, recalling her abuse with Shannon Sharpe. And I would say the thing that tonally made it have a lot of gravity was, you know, in this kind of post-TikTok, everybody, indicting myself here, just seems just a little too ready for a camera and too ready for a microphone. And she just did not have that polish. She had all the clarity of somebody telling the truth, but all of the demeanor of somebody who was not interested in public life and who was saying this. And that's just something you can feel. That's a vibe you can feel. And that felt like it wasn't tinged with what the original 19-year-old accuser had, because unfortunately there was a lot of murky stuff going on with that evidence and that unraveling that gave big enough gaps to say, you know, he might be a freak nasty man, but does he deserve jail? Whereas this one, you're like, okay, well, if you already gonna open up Ultraz, I got the first Negro, apparently. Oh,
goodness. Not Miles at the short list for Alcatraz.
No.
And the last pop culture thing, I don't know if you saw the video that went viral with Shiloh Hendricks, the white woman in the park who uses a racial slur towards the little boy. So that was like its own thing. And then as of the recording, I think she has raised $643,000 on Give Get Go, which I think is a Christian GoFundMe site. Because she said that her life is in danger because the video went viral of her being racist, of her using a race, calling the little boy the N-word. And she is saying that, her life is unraveling. But $600,000 she's raised over this incident. And that has blown my mind. I'm not going to lie.
Well, that's how come I don't think that these people just are confused. Just to connect some stuff. Yeah. I'm like, now how? What's the excuse for that one right there?
The confusing thing, I think what I also believe, because I do think some people, these people clearly are not confused, is that I worry about the left trying to recruit these people as opposed to trying to recruit our people who just don't come out. Because I do think there are more people on our side who are confused or just don't are not listening in a certain way, who are winnable. They will get it. They like, you know, they believe in things like due process. They think that shipping people to other countries with no hearings is crazy. Like, they think that 2-year-olds should not be sitting in immigration hearings. But people aren't talking to them. People have given up on them as like just low ID voters. And you're like, no, they the people you need. Because the people donating to Shiloh Hendricks, you lost cause. There's no speech that's going to get them back.
And they dedicated to the lost cause. They still fly the lost cause flag. You can't get them back.
Got their whole names on this fundraiser. Yes. I'm like, that's wild.
Yes.
Lost them and never had them. I think the weird thing about the psychology of white folks, too, is the fact that there is a type of twisted compassion when you see those kind of videos. Because I do think for a lot of white people, specifically those who find themselves on this far right side of politics or racial politics, is that they feel like, no, I'm exercising a muscle to not disrespect black people. I'm exercising a muscle to not put place black people back on their social cast. And I empathize with somebody who whose muscle fails them and they say the N-word. And I don't think that's a reason for somebody's life, financial or social, to unravel because of that. So I think it's the empathy around it. And just like the I was watching a Bell Hooks lecture, and she was years ago, which is depressing, but like years ago she was saying, you know, the idea, the temperature around white folks and black justice is, we already gave y'all enough, y'all have enough, what justice? Like, that is her, that was her read of white people's feelings around it. And I think that extends to moments like this where it's like, oh my goodness, like, you're asking for too much. Like, we have to respect you too, and we always have to be perfect. No.
While we were recording, the Bureau of Prisons released a statement about Trump's Alcatraz tweet, because if we did not say this earlier, Trump said he's going to reopen Alcatraz on Twitter. That's how we all found out about it, including the Bureau of Prisons. The Bureau of Prisons said, and I quote, "The Bureau of Prisons will comply with all presidential orders. When we get additional information, we will be happy to provide it." What a joke. Just one big joke.
And for the record, no matter what happens, I want the record to show that we complied and incremental changed our way into hell. So hell is not just paved with good intentions. It's paved with incremental change and just complying and just doing what the rules say.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned. There's more to come. Now, you've heard me rave about Z-Biotics before, but let me tell you, I cannot say enough good things about the sugar to fiber probiotic that Z-Biotics makes. Now, since I've been in the gym, I've been focused on vitamins and protein and all these other things that I didn't know anything about. But fiber is one of them. I never thought about my fiber in my diet. It wasn't a thing that I had ever been told about. I didn't learn it in school. It wasn't until I started working out that I was like, oh, I need to pay attention to this. And then I realized how annoyingly hard it is to get the right amount of fiber every day. And that's why Z-Biotics comes in. Now, let me tell you a bit about Z-Biotics. There's a team of PhD microbiologists over at Z-Biotics that understood that 95% of Americans don't get enough fiber. So they genetically engineered a probiotic drink mix called sugar to fiber. Now, sugar to fiber turns sugar in the foods that you eat into a prebiotic fiber called leaven fiber. And it's really hard to get leaven from a typical diet, and it helps to improve the amount and diversity of fiber that your body receives. I use the sugar to fiber probiotic mix when I come back from the gym and I make a smoothie. So I go to the gym pretty early in the morning, come back, make a smoothie. And I put this in there because it converts the sugar in the foods that I'm already eating into fiber throughout the day. I mean, it is truly a game changer for me, and the only way that I make sure that I get my fiber intake in a given day. Now, I put some fruits and stuff in my smoothie too, but this is my main source of fiber for a given day. And as I get older, my gut health is just way more important to me, and that's why I can't recommend Z-Biotics sugar to fiber any more than I already have. It is key to my daily routine. And here's the thing. If you go to zbiotics.com/PSTP and use code PSTP at checkout, you'll get 15% off any first-time orders of Z-Biotics probiotics. Z-Biotics has 100% money-back guarantee, so if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. Thank you, Z-Biotics, for sponsoring this episode.
Bang, bang. Bang, bang.
And on to the news of the week. The first Monday in May is always a big deal in these American streets because it is the Met Gala. And we have our cultural correspondent, the one and only Miles E. Johnson, here to lead us through.
Ooh, let them eat cake, right? So I'm so curious about this year's Met Gala because, A, it's centering around male, black male style. And I think as somebody who's utilized fashion and just as we're all a part of a culture that utilizes fashion in order to arm ourselves, in order to express ourselves, and also to negotiate self-expression and safety. So the more culturally or heritage front-facing you want to be, maybe the more tuxedoed you want to be or the more dandy or dapper that you want to be. And I think this is such an interesting thing to explore right now because we're outside of a Kendrick Lamar and Drake beef. So something happened and changed with that about how black men want to be represented that kind of was democratically chosen inside of hip hop. And then we also are seeing this like rupture with Shannon Sharp, with Diddy, with Eric Adams. So this feels like such an interesting moment to talk about black men, but then black men and black men style, but also because it's at the Met Gala in this moment. And I remember last year, or a couple of years from now, the Met Gala got tore up because one of the influencers said, "Let them eat cake." And it was seen as elitist and tone deaf. It was happening during the genocide in Palestine and people just were disgusted by it. It's interesting to see now black men feels like the barrier to maybe insulate Vogue in the Met Gala from those type of critiques. You can't critique us for this. Because look, we're centering black men, you know, and that's what this kind of feels like. Instead of just saying, you know what, the Met Gala is something that we invented. It is another social construct like race. So we can just recreate it or put it on hold for later when the vibes is a little bit better. But that's just not a part of the ever expansive project of capitalist ventures. So they have to keep it going. But it's interesting to see who they chose to protect themselves from critique. And also sometimes where it's always a struggle because the black artist is so sacred to me, but the black celebrity is such a heinous class traitor. Cause you see somebody who I love, who I felt compelled to talk about, like Doshi, also participate in the hyper consumerism that Andre Lee and Tally showed that listen, I think is beautiful that I still is an architect in my own style world, but I'm just like, how disconnected do you have to be from the temperature of the rest of the world to think this is the time to deploy that stuff? And even in the wake of Andre Leon Talley's death, who died in such a penniless way. So we also know that performance of extravagance in luxury was also minstrelsy because he was only performing it because when it actually came down to what money he had, what property he had, what power he had, we know that he didn't have any. Unfortunately, and that's also a layer of his truth during the last days of his life, or the last years of his life, rather. And then, and I want to say this with a huge asterisk because I'm saying this before the Met Gala, I also think that the vacancy of Andre Leon Talley, the not having him be a part of some of these style in Vogue moments feels a little strange. I understand that there's other celebrities and even other influencers or fashion influencers who are talking about it, but Anna Wintour was his friend. Even in his documentary, she names him as this encyclopedia that helped her be able to architect the new pathways for Vogue. So he's not just somebody who was just a clever purse for her to wear that spoke in this found European accent that he would wear. He was also this huge intellectual historical archive that she utilized in order to find her own wealth and her own sovereign independence from her family. And to not see him centered in something that is so obviously touched by his ghost feels wrong. And feel strange. So with saying that, I'll still be looking at the outfits. I will still be trying to recreate them with my thrift stores and my Zara's because I am in America, and part of being in America is living in the contradiction and the paradox of it. And, you know, just bathe me in Target bags and blood, I guess.
I am so glad you kicked us off, because I don't have much to add and don't have to after that. But I do think that I'm fascinated by their decision to go with this theme also in this political moment, right? I think not just for the reasons you named, which are about sort of insulating themselves from critiques about the rest of the world being on fire and leveraging Black people as the shields in that way, right? But also just in a moment where everything that is about centering Black people feels like it's under attack, right? Our institutions, our museums, et cetera, right? And so, like, I'm very curious to see if or how people might leverage this as a political moment to make a statement about that, something kind of more global than just the gala. But my sense is, and I think in some of the folks that you have named and have talked about, people are just happy to be there. Like, they're striving to be invited. And I don't know that people want to run the risk of not being invited again to whatever other thing the people that they're going to be at the gala with might do. And so I think might just play nice, which would be really disappointing if that were true.
Yeah, I think, and I don't even know if they'll play nice, Sharona, but I do think that I hope that this moment will be one where Black people get to be really subversive about how they do their thing. Like, I think there'll be style moments that Black people will get and references that Black people will get that will be political and solidarity building. And I do, you know, I think there's often no substitute for being in the room. Now, we should be able to make our own rooms too, and the Met Gala is certainly not the only room in fashion. And there was another big launch that Jawara and Jared did, a Black Hair. They launched a Black Hair collective. You probably saw the pictures of Jules with the straight hair that went viral. Like, they launched a new thing during this moment. It's not Fashion Week, but it is cool to see the Black fashion crowd just become more powerful and not need things like the Met Gala to be relevant and to be there. You know, Anna was listening. Miles, I don't know if you saw that. On April 16th, in a special essay, she wrote an entire essay about Andre Leon Talley, specifically referencing how much she was inspired by him for this theme. So somebody got to Anna and was like, get in front of this before it's a thing. I'll read a part of it. She said, I thought of Andre so many times, happy and bittersweet moments mixed together. I thought of how even when he was doing something one might have found slightly over the top, playing tennis in full Vuitton, for instance, it was for Andre an act of supreme confidence, of total self-possession. Andre knew who he was, and I know how much he would have adored Superfine, every aspect of it, the planning, the press conferences, an issue of Vogue dedicated to it, the exhibition catalog, how many outfits he would have planned for the parties to come, and not just for him, but for me, for everyone in my family, his friends, my friends, muses, fashionable acquaintances, anyone at hand. So I do appreciate that. And I don't know if you saw Doechii made that ode to him with the Vuitton.
That's what I was thinking about when I said that.
It was just cool. And a couple other people did too. And I think the critique is right. It's so interesting in the moments when people use the power of Black culture to resurrect brands, to defend brands, to message brands, and we run the internet, and every Black person, whether we like fashion or not, will be tuned in to every single outfit that happens on Monday. And like, that is, money can't buy that. There's no amount of press that can, you know, so I'm interested in that. And shout out to Miss Tina's book launch, by the way, because talk about a press launch. This is random, but they had Miss Tina everywhere. Miss Tina, it was like, you didn't even know she was writing a book. And then she was in every magazine. She was on every TV show. They did that. Yvette, you did that.
Yeah. So many good interviews and clips and histories that she's like been sharing. I feel like every morning I wake up to something different to her. I got to touch a little bit what you said, Duray.
Okay, what's up?
I do think that those moments in the Met Gala also show like the limits of Black exceptionalism and excellence inside of like systems. Like, there's something about the fact that, yeah, you can resist all you want, be a subversive all you want, but you're still at the end of the day creating spectacle to help this institution and to help consumerism. And I think that that is part of the reason, maybe why I feel so shaky recently around so many things that we make spectacle, because I'm realizing that sometimes we can take Black consumerism habits or black internet habits as black political or ethical or intellectual progress. And it's just not. It's just us liking to see each other on television and us having this kind of cathartic, incestuous moment when we see each other on the red carpet and saying, one day that could be me, or that feels like it's me, and that being what we're addicted to, not progress. And that's scary.
That makes sense. And that makes me think about Saquon Barkley as like a really good example. I remember I have only been around him once, and it was actually Fashion Week. He was at like a Fashion Week party. Virgil had thrown it, and I got there early, and he had also gotten there. And I have, I don't watch football. I don't have any deep feelings about him as a football player, but I was shocked to see him be such a Trumper, only because like he knows how much black boys look up to him. He know like it is that actually matters, and his blackness is a part of what makes him relevant and interesting. And I do hope that there's like a cost for people like that. Him, Nelly, like the whole crew. He just is the flavor of the week in terms of the latest Trump supporter. But it is, I think I get worried when people can shield themselves with the celebrity of Trump and not have to contend with the ideas that he supports. And like, I'm like, ah, this is crazy. But it makes me think about that with you. What you said, Miles, is that like we can be so enamored with the visibility of the Met Gala, everybody being together. And you're like, what does it mean to have our biggest black celebrities all in one room, all in one place in the biggest city in the country? And the thing they are called to do is take a picture. And you're like, well, that, you're like, in this political moment, that cannot be it. Like that, what a colossal failure of organizing. That makes sense to me.
Yes, and.
Okay, what you got? What you got? Okay. What you got? Sometimes, I wasn't even there until Miles took me there. Then I was like,
I hear you, and I 100% agree with you. And I am like, when do we just get to be? Like, when do we just get to have a good time? Like, why does everything that we do come with the additional burden or responsibility of seeing our behavior
as political? Okay, I might be sold.
Right? Like, why? You know? It's like, and so that's part of what's sitting with me too, is like this tension where it's like, you know, how many times do you have to show up? How many causes do you have to donate to? How many protests do you have to go to? Not necessarily to like offset your participation at the Met Gala, right? But for people to like know your politic and be like, and I'm still gonna look good and have a good time. Like, why can't I do both of those things? Is sort of what is sitting with me as listening to the two of you. I'm finna get red in the comments, but yeah.
I think that's fair. As somebody who I feel like I have nothing left to prove, and the one night that I go out, people are like, DeRay is, and I'm like, oh my God, I really couldn't work any harder. I like just one night. Maybe it is that people misrepresent what the nights are, and they talk about nights like this as political statements, and you're like, no, it was just entertainment, right?
Yeah.
And like, let it be entertainment. Let it be like, let us name it as entertainment. Let's not talk about it as like a black power moment. And you're like, maybe that is a compromise. Miles is like, and I don't know.
It's just that we went through, almost 10 years, almost 10 or 20 years of everything being radical, right? And like all of our like kind of choice consumption habits being radical. And we have so many artists who didn't just found their way through whimsy and through artistic curiosity to find themselves happen to be at the Met Gala. We have artists who intentionally wrote things on their backs that talk to political change. We have artists who intentionally evoke certain types of ancestral nostalgic memory in order to rise us up. We have artists who donned costumes during some of our biggest spectacles that evoke black revolutionary moments. So I hear that, but it just kind of falls flat, because if that's the game and you're just like, well, I just want one night of rest or fun, then how come you ain't doing that in Mississippi? How come all y'all rich folk don't go to Mississippi and create y'all own thing? And everybody who's a part of the Black Fashion Fair, which is a fabulous publication that I love, why don't y'all go there and to fund that and create your own thing if it's just about black people having fun and loosening up? Why do you always have to have your fun, loosen up, be carefree, and let your image of your celebrity be in service to the expansion of a white supremacist media structure? Why is that always got going on?
Listen, as somebody who does nonprofit fundraising, I think a lot about how wealthy black people leverage their wealth to get access to spaces that help expand like their own individual goals. And this is another example of that, right? But I think it's like also important for us to remember, like, you going to the Met Gala ain't got shit to do with me, you know, like at all. It's not. And I think if we also, this is part of why I'm like, should we see everything through a political lens? Because I think if we are a little bit more critical of when people sort of engage in those kinds of antics or statements, I think then we can see it for what it is. And we're not disappointed when at the end of the night, nothing has changed.
That makes sense. Look at that. That was good. We worked that through. And Sharonda, you're right. I have been in a lot of rooms, and let me tell you, I'm the biggest asker in the world. I just saw Purpose on Broadway, which everybody should see. I went backstage, and when I first got back there, I talked to two of the leads. I'm like, we run a speakers program at the juvenile jail in Cleveland. You did, like, when's this play over? Can y'all come to Cleveland? They're like, we got you, you know? And like, there's something about being in the room that just like allows you to make the ask.
Yeah.
Don't go anywhere. More Pod Save the People's coming. Today's episode is sponsored by Acorns. Acorns is a financial wellness app that helps you take control of your money with simple tools that make it easy to start saving and investing for your future. You don't need to be an expert. Acorns will recommend a diversified portfolio that matches you and your money goals. You don't need to be rich. Acorns lets you get started with the spare money you've got right now, even if all you've got is spare change. And the cool thing is you don't need a ton of time. You can create your Acorns account and start investing in just 5 minutes. And you don't need to feel like this whole financial wellness process is impossible. Acorns gives you small, simple steps to get you and your money on track. Basically, Acorns does the hardest part for you so it can give your money a chance to grow. Now, I knew nothing about the investing process. Lord knows, I didn't grow up in a household where this was a topic. Acorns was my introduction to this. And I'll tell you, it was much easier than I thought it would be. I was overwhelmed by even the prospect of it. And then I was like, okay, this is actually really simple. I got it. Much simpler than I thought it could be. Ready to take control of your money? Sign up now and join the over 14 million all-time customers who've already saved and invested over $25 billion with Acorns. Head to acorns.com/PSDP or download the Acorns app to get started. Paid non-client endorsement. Compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Tier 1 compensation provided. Investing involves risk. Acorns Advisors, LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor. View important disclosures at acorns.com/PSTP. Well, my news is about more politics, but it is about the drop in support amongst Latinos for Donald Trump. So with exit polls from the Trump election, it looked like Trump received almost 50% of the Latino vote last fall. So 46% according to exit polls. And now we have just passed the 100-day mark, and it looks like he is around in between 27 and 34%, according to a host of polls. And then two additional Latino polls, like Latino specifically focused polls, confirm the decline. And I just thought it was interesting to put here. Also wanted to put alongside, I don't know if you saw the, it was Van Jones did a segment where he was talking to like three Black Trump supporters. It's like three or four Black Trump supporters, but he did this whole segment and they were like, you know, we don't regret it. Da, 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 da. So that blew my mind. But the Latino poll was interesting to me because I remember watching this moment around the election and I'm like, y'all, he don't care about y'all. He don't care about us. I know he don't care about Black people. And I know he's going to call every not Black but not white person an immigrant the moment he, like some sort of illegal person the moment he can. And now he's sending people to El Salvador just on vibes. Doctor of photos saying we think they're in a gang. So the dip in support doesn't surprise me. I just am. First of all, I'm like, it's not lower. That surprised me. I'm like, how is his approval rating even over 7%? You know, I'm like, Fox News is doing dirty work, really just screwing us over. But I wanted to bring it here because yeah, according to one poll, they said that 63% of Latino voters believe that Trump has gone too far on immigration. And I'm sort of like with Trump narratively on this one, where he's like, y'all, I'm just doing what I said I was going to do. Like, he was actually crystal clear about this one. You know, this was not one where he surprised. And then there was 43% reported that their family is struggling to keep up with everyday expenses. You know, he did sort of lie. He said everything was going to be cheaper. So, like, if you believed him, then you did get hoodwinked on that one. And then among those who rated their situation as barely getting by, 91% said Trump's tariffs will increase inflation. Well, you know, he also said he was going to do the tariffs. So, you know, I don't know. And then the Unidos U.S. poll, nearly 2/3 of Latino voters said the country is headed in the wrong direction, and 70% blamed President Trump. 54% said the economy is worse than it was a year ago. Half expect things to keep getting worse, and 49% blame Trump for the rising cost of living. And then 60% said the administration is not focused enough on making everyday necessities more affordable. I don't know. I'm sitting here like, this is when I'm not, you know, like, I told you so, it's not helpful. And I'm like, Kamala was actually, like, I think people did not like Kamala the person, and I get it. Like, whatever, I've heard the critiques. But she was also clear about what that man was saying. Like, she was a good storyteller about what he was saying. People thought she was, might have been corny or whatever, I don't know. But, like, I remember her talking about the tariffs and people being like, you fear-mongerer. Like, how dare you? I remember her talking about Project Kill the World, whatever it's called, 2025. And people are like, he said that's not his project. Kamala's lying to people. And here we are. Okay, I'll stop rambling now. But what are y'all thoughts on the poll?
I think that people thought that they would know who he was going to attack and deport, right? Like, I think they were like, he doesn't mean me. You know what I mean? It's almost like an experience I have as like a Black woman and feminist listening to rap music where I'm like, yes, he's using the B word, but he's not talking about me. And he's 100% talking about me. You know what I mean? Like, there's this dissonance that you kind of have to have sometimes in order to like enjoy the thing or believe in the thing or do the thing. And I think lots of Latino voters were having that degree of dissonance, right? Where they were like, I have been here forever. I'm a hard worker. He's not talking about me. He's not talking about people like me. And I think they realized, to your point, really quickly, no, he meant all of you. There is no distinction, right? I think the last thing I will say, particularly about Latino identity in the US, is that it's really complicated and really diverse. And so I think it would be interesting to like see how people are thinking about like people who identify as Black Latinos versus people who are like white proximate or white passing Latinos, right? And like how that support or dip in support breaks down along those lines. Because I feel like what happened is whiteness was starting to expand in the way that whiteness has to in order to survive, to include some Latino communities, right? And that is kind of where they were voting and where they were going. And then they realized, in the same way that those Black men who were out here parading around for Trump, that there was no room in the end for them. Those people got in there and closed the door behind them. And so their proximity to whiteness, real or perceived, did not save them. And I would be very curious to know if that is where he is seeing both the remaining support and also steepest declines in support.
It reminded me of what you even said earlier, Duray, around just like all the reasons why people voted for, like why they voted. And one of the reasons that I forgot or didn't articulate to mention is that, you know, another reason is we're just having a cognitive intellectual emergency. And I think that not just that cognitive intellectual emergency is not just around people not reading and people not studying and et cetera, et cetera. It's also about people not trusting. I think that you have to trust the people you're learning from and trust the people who you're hearing from. And I think that when it comes to the progress of America, Black people, Black queer people are usually the stewards of that progression, and we're just not trusted as intellectual bearers of intellect or of good thought. And unfortunately, this is interesting, I saw Anna Navarro talking about this, and she didn't quite say the words I'm about to use, but she was saying how in America, that was the first time she became Latino. And she was saying it in a kind of positive way of saying she feels camaraderie around other Latinos here, and it's not just about her. But also what it made me think of, because how my brain works, is also that wiping and that forgetting of culture and how that is something that America does. And that's almost an initiation. There is no community that got absorbed into whiteness that was not initiated by terrorism and was not initiated by poverty. So there, it's just interesting to be in this place as a Black person who remembers Bush And remember, and Mamas remembers Reagan, to see a group of people fall victim to things that we try to warn about and that we already experienced, that kind of great forgetting.
Even the Latino Bushes, right? Like, the for a long time, there was a belief that, you know, that some of the Latino folks who had married into the Bush family and had, you know, children with Bushes, that like they were going to be the next generation of rising Republican stars. I don't know if you guys remember that, like the George Prescott Bushes of the world. Yeah, right. So I think yes, yes.
This makes me think about the Mecca in the sense that I do think that one of white supremacy's like enduring tools is its seduction, like its seductiveness, like the, and it is the pageantry and the institutions that seduce you. It is things like the Met Gala that you don't even realize you're like reinforcing, because that's not why you're going. Like, you're not, no, the black people are not going there to be like, ooh, let's uphold this white institution. That's not, nobody's, that's not a conscious thing. But they want to participate in this legacy thing that just is doing, it means all these things. And I said it because I can think about, especially during the election and after, like the number of people who are seduced by like Trump's quote bravado and his quote truth telling is like actually just the seduction of white power. Because he is everything people hate. He is a convicted felon. He is, you know, is a failed businessman. Like, on any other body, these would be deal breakers. And, you know, Miles, like you and you, Sharonda, there is a question of like, how long will people continue to be seduced? You're like, you know, what is Bell Hooks? Bell Hooks got a big chunk of people off the train. Baldwin got a big chunk of people off the train. But like, it's still a lot of people. You know who's not on the train? Our sister, dear sister Solange. We need to kick out Donald Trump and put Solange in. We have a whole different everything in this place.
I was going to say, a tie-in is actually when Solange was like, I don't know why y'all keep going to these damn award shows. Like,
that's what I was thinking of.
Yes.
Yeah, sister Solange said, no thanks.
Yes.
Yeah. She said it with the Grammy in tow. And Solange is my favorite. Like, I think that she is just she's a black genius, her and Beyonce. But I think that is always the struggle, you know? And I think that's always the thing where it's like, no, like, how do you like negotiate those different things? And yeah, it's hard.
But I actually think that Solange having the Grammy makes it more powerful, because I think about the number of black people I know who we, like, I would consider myself one of them, who participated in the thing because you didn't know any better. You know, like, you thought that was what, like, that was what the reward was. And then you got it and you were like, this don't mean that. You're like, oh, this is a scam. But you didn't know it was a scam until you actually went through it. And I think there are a lot of people like that.
Well, my news to round this out is a shift in a completely different direction, but it is about the potential development of a universal anti-venom. So, you know, every year snakes across the world, poisonous venomous snakes across the world, bite about 2.7 million people, and about 120,000 of those people die, and about 400,000 of those people end up with some significant injury, right? And like lifelong complication from a snake bite. And the anti-venom was first developed like 130 years ago, but much about how we develop it hasn't changed in that time. And in fact, you almost have to have like the specific anti-venom for the specific snake that bit you, right? Which is, as you know, complicated. And if you're in a rural, you know, part of some poor country, the likelihood that you will get access to that anti-venom is pretty slim, right? And so there's this man who is a white man from the United States who has been slowly injecting himself with anti-venom and then letting live snakes bite him so that his body can start to build up immunity and begin to produce what scientists are now calling a new universal or potentially universal anti-venom. And so I'm bringing that to the pod, one, because I find these kinds of scientific advancements really fascinating. And I think about how people in other parts of the world are constantly navigating challenges that just don't even occur to me, right? Like the fact that you could be in your home and a snake would slither in and like kill you or your child is like, sorry, it's like, it's hard for me, right? But it's a reality for a lot of people, right? And so, you know, I am thinking about that. I find that really fascinating. And also I'm like, you know, they tell the story of the first time he let himself get bit by two live snakes. They were two cobras. He said he was fine after the first one, and the second one, then he passed out and woke up 4 days later, right? And I was like, this is wild to me. Wild. And I'm just fascinated by the human body, right? Which is why I'm also always bringing these kinds of stories to the pod. But yeah, just like a general curiosity and a like, wow, what a cool potential scientific advancement.
You hold it down for, I would have never found this story on a good day, bad day, in between day, because this was not on any radar of mine. And I think I have a lot of good sources.
Did you watch the video?
No, the reading the thing was enough. I was like, this is so nuts. I'm just like, I want to go through like the actual thought in his mind when he's like, you know, I'm going to let them bite me.
Yes.
And like, what job do you have? Like what time do you have in the day to even think about this? And what was your speech to the doctors? Like, hey, I let all the snakes bite me. Can you like test me to see it? Like, I'm like, how did you even, I don't even know. I'm just so, yeah, this is the WTF award for the podcast. This guy has no clue.
I really did. I loved your retelling, your soft retelling of this story in this article. Thank you. For somebody who, you know, just has too vivid imagination, I was like, I can't do this. So this feels like positive information, despite the oddness, right? And what it did make me think about and map on top of it is the kind of ongoing conversation we've had around going back to the South and reclaiming farmland. And what excited me in it, not just because of this advancement, but just other advancements we'll have is like that return to, or that idea of returning to farmland with better medicines and better technologies to help us survive, but then also to help us do things more efficiently. So that felt like a little thing. That felt like a little thing in my head. I was trying to wrap it
really
up.
That was a real stretch there. You took a nice lean and stretch. To the front. But shout out to him. You know, if we get a universal anti-venom and it's thanks to this guy who put his body and life on the line proactively, then shout out to him.
Yeah. That's reverse reparations eugenics. That's what you should be doing with your white body. Because you know what? As long as you granted permission, unlike us.
Now, you know, who knows, though, the FDA doesn't exist, so. Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning in to Pod Save the People this week. Tell your friends to check it out and make sure you rate it wherever you get your podcast, whether it's Apple Podcasts or somewhere else. And we'll see you next week. Pod Save the People is a production of Crooked Media. It's produced by AJ Moultrie and mixed by Evan Sutton. Executive produced by me, and special thanks to our weekly contributors, Kai Henderson, Dr. Ballinger, and Miles E. Johnson. Our production staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America East.